Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Judy Bello, an active member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, who talks about her recent trip to Pakistan, where she discovered what most Americans don't know about the consequences of U.S. drone strikes there. Excerpts of testimony presented before the Bertrand Russell International Tribunal on Palestine in New York City in early October. And BBC reporter and author Greg Palast, who discusses his investigation into the purge of minority voters across the country, which could play a decisive role in determining winners and losers in the 2012 election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations is warning of a potential food crisis in 2013 as global grain reserves fall to the lowest level in 40 years. Poor harvests in the United States, Ukraine, and Australia have raised the risk of spiking food prices, creating political instability not seen since the food riots in 2008 that shook 30 nations. Oxfam International has predicted prices for wheat and corn could double in the next 20 years, driving developing countries further into extreme poverty. Today, Egypt is the largest importer of wheat in the world, and half the country relies on subsidized bread to survive. Under pressure from foreign donors, the bread subsidy has been cut. Food prices will likely continue to rise as Egypt seeks a bailout from the International Monetary Fund. In the Central American nation of Guatemala, the price of a tortilla made with U.S. imported corn has risen dramatically since 2010. It now costs over $10 a day to feed a family of four, beyond the capacity of low-income workers. After the 2008 food crisis, Asian countries, including the Philippines and Indonesia, built up rice reserves to forestall future food panics and hoarding. So far this year, the reserves have succeeded in preventing a spike in rice prices. Colombian-born Jessica Lopez arrived in East Boston with her mother when she was 6 years old. Now the undocumented immigrant is going part-time to college to become a medical interpreter. Lopez's dreams took a huge step forward when she applied for a work permit under President Obama's Mini Dream Act, known as Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. The initiative covers 1.7 million immigrants between the ages of 17 and 31 who are now eligible for a 2-year deferral from deportation and a work permit. So far, over 82,000 college-age immigrants have applied for DACA status. Right-wing anti-immigrant opponents have blasted Obama's order as amnesty and unfair to people waiting for legal immigration status. Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney recently told the Denver Post he would not deport immigrants who are currently protected from deportation, but would refuse to grant any future deferrals or work permits. During the primary, Romney frequently called for the self-deportation of undocumented immigrants. A massive proposed wind farm in Central California, the Avalon Wind Project, is in a holding pattern waiting for the outcome of the presidential election. The developers have their construction permits and contractors, but there's uncertainty about the future of federal wind power tax credits. These credits expire in December, and prospects look dim if Mitt Romney wins the White House on November 6th. A third of the wind farm's construction costs would be paid by federal tax credits. Mark Thulke of EDF Renewable Energy, the Avalon Project developer, warned the loss of the 20-year-old wind tax credit would be devastating. The number of wind projects built would just plummet. According to the Los Angeles Times, 170,000 jobs in California are linked to the green economy, including renewable energy, conservation, and pollution reduction. Severin Borenstein of the Energy Institute of the University of California's Haas School of Business observed, "The election will have a huge impact on California energy policy." In its 2009 economic stimulus package, the Obama White House allocated over $13 billion for the development of renewable energy. The administration also endorsed a clean energy standard for 2035 that requires 80% of electricity to come from cleaner energy sources, including natural gas and more controversial sources such as nuclear power. In contrast, the Romney campaign marginalizes the development of wind and solar power and favors the more aggressive exploitation of fossil fuels. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
A delegation of 31 Americans from all walks of life traveled to Pakistan in early October on a delegation organized by the group Code Pink Women for Peace with the goal of witnessing firsthand the damage wrought by U.S. drone strikes. Delegates on the trip, coinciding with the 11th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, traveled to the federally administered tribal area of Waziristan, the first time the Pakistani government has admitted foreigners to the region in nearly a decade. While in Pakistan, the Americans participated in an anti-drone rally in the city of Hatala, met with Pakistanis who have been victims of U.S. drone strikes, and participated in a one-day fast in memory of the estimated 450 to 800 civilians, including 160 children, killed by U.S. drones since 2004. While the U.S. drone program is a contentious and divisive issue inside Pakistan, here in the U.S., there's little disagreement among politicians or discussion of the topic in the nation's corporate media. That was clearly illustrated in the last of three presidential debates on October 22nd, when Republican candidate Mitt Romney, responding to moderator Bob Schieffer's question on drones, expressed full support for President Obama's policy of using unmanned weapons to attack terrorist targets inside Pakistan's tribal areas near the Afghan border. Your reporter spoke with Judy Bellow, an active member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation from upstate New York, who traveled with the Code Pink delegation to Pakistan. Here she recounts the story she heard from victims of drone attacks and the message she carried to Pakistan that Americans care about their plight and there is a clear distinction between the policies of the American government and its people.
In general, we all wanted to do a couple of things. One was to reach out to the people there and to let them know that somebody cares about what's happening to them, because through our own research, we'd already really found out that there was something bad going on there and that these people were being harmed. So the other side of that is that we wanted to be able to come back here to America and say to people, I was there, this is who I met, this is what I saw, and hope to really influence public opinion a little bit. Because this is really a terrible program that the United States is involved in right now, where we're bombing in several countries that we're not at war with. And in general, these attacks are happening. I'm not so sure about Somalia, but I'm pretty sure it's also true in Yemen. We're bombing rural areas where even their own government has not provided enough resources, and where the people are really very, very vulnerable. So it's really not the right way to go about finding the bad guys, so to speak, because even if there are some bad guys that go there, they also can travel incognito through the cities, you know. And it's much better, I would think, to actually do on-the-ground police work than to really just sort of randomly bomb locations because you're pretty sure there's a bad guy somewhere around there. It's just really not a good policy.
Maybe you could tell some stories about the people you met and how the drone strikes have affected their own personal lives and the lives of their family members.
There is a gentleman named Noor Biram who is a photographer. And when he saw what was happening, he's a resident of Waziristan, when he saw what was happening, he went out and he started taking pictures. He's taken pictures of over 100 children who've been killed in these strikes, along with many more. I guess I'll talk about his instances first, because those are children. There was a little girl killed in a strike in May of 2010, and her name was Fatima. She was 6 years old. And she was sleeping in bed at night with her family. She and two of her father's wives, including her own mother, and two of her siblings were killed in this drone strike. There was a target, was an Egyptian guy who they, you know, associate with Al-Qaeda. They say he was there, and I think by now it's pretty clear he was, but at the time they weren't even really positive of that. He was there just spending the night because the standards of hospitality in that region are if somebody knocks on your door, you give them a meal and let them spend the night. That's just the way it's done. So this child and her entire family, really, were murdered along with one bad guy who happened to be there at the time, but it was the middle of the night. And I think something we need to understand in America, when we read these things in the newspaper, the language kind of obscures the reality. When they say that the drone attacked a compound, in that region, everybody lives in a compound. So if they attacked a compound in the middle of the night, you could be guaranteed that women and children were there with the men.
Judy, what are the repercussions of these drone strikes in Pakistan among the people that you met? In terms of anger at the U.S., there have been some observers who say these drone strikes don't accomplish much in terms of attacking known terrorists, but rather are a very effective terrorist recruitment tool, driving people with their anger into the ranks of al-Qaeda and other organizations.
Well, there's some evidence, actually, that that's true. There are a number of cases we were told about, and I don't have the names at my fingertips, of people who were found to have joined al-Qaeda after a family member was killed in a drone strike. Their tribal code is that if somebody injures you, that you essentially get revenge or you get even. There's another level of this, though, which has to do with the feeling in Pakistani society as a whole. And people at large are very, very opposed to these drone strikes in Pakistan. They think that Americans must just not care about anyone. And they were really shocked to see us there, actually. And it was very interesting to listen to their reaction or to hear their reaction to our presence, because they just couldn't believe that anybody bothered to come. And many Pakistanis were in themselves afraid to come with us up to the tribal lands because the government has barred people from going there for many years, basically to hide the drone strikes.
That was Judy Bello, an active member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation from upstate New York, who traveled with a recent Code Pink Women for Peace delegation to Pakistan. Learn more about the Code Pink delegation and the U.S. drone program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The fourth and last session of the Bertrand Russell International Tribunal on Palestine took place in New York City on October 6th and 7th. A distinguished panel of judges, including Alice Walker, Angela Davis, and Native American activist Dennis Banks among the American participants, heard testimony from activists, academics, and human rights defenders about the role of the United States and the United Nations in permitting the continued oppression of the Palestinian people by the State of Israel. The first three sessions of the tribunal were held in London, Barcelona, Spain, and Cape Town, South Africa. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the New York session and recorded excerpts of testimony from Diana Boutu, a Palestinian-Canadian attorney and former spokesperson with the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and Salah Abdel Jawad, a Palestinian historian who teaches at Beerzit University in the West Bank. We hear first from Boutu, who focused on how the U.S. position on Palestine has changed over the years, becoming much more accommodating toward Israel, a point also made by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter on a recent trip to Israel, where he was critical of both Israeli and American leaders for abandoning peace negotiations that would lead to a two-state solution.
So instead, I want to look again at how the United States has aimed to make legal what is otherwise illegal. And one of the ways that they have done this is by changing the roles and flipping the roles of the occupied and the occupier. Now, again, you don't need to have a legal treatise to know that people resist, that people demand their freedom, that people want to be free and will use any means necessary to achieve their freedom. But what the United States has since done, through the provision of the Oslo Accords, was that it has flipped it on its head. Rather than the occupier being required to provide security to the occupied, rather than the occupier being required to protect the occupied, we are now in a very perverse situation in which the occupied, the Palestinians, are required to give protection to their oppressor, Israel. And this is what has happened through the construction of the Palestinian Authority, through the way that the Palestinian Authority has operated, through the fact that the majority of the money that the Palestinian Authority gets is for the provision of security. In fact, more money goes towards the Palestinian Authority's Ministry of Security than goes to education and health combined. Again, this is the idea, is that it's making legal what is otherwise illegal. It is flipping it on its head. Now, a third way in which the United States has, again, flipped these things on its head is by creating a system in which Palestinians have to negotiate for their freedom. And this has been the number one push. We keep hearing this time and time and time again, over and over by the U.S. administration and other administrations. We urge the parties to get back to the negotiating table. And the question is to get back to the negotiating table to do what? So again, the Palestinians have to negotiate their way out of their occupation. They have to negotiate their way into freedom. Again, the whole idea is that they've made legal what is otherwise illegal. They flipped things on their heads.
That was Diana Bhutu, a Canadian-Palestinian attorney who formerly worked for the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and is best known for her work as a legal advisor and negotiator between Israeli and Palestinian organizations. Palestinian historian Saleh Abdal-Jawad's presentation focused on the concept of sociocide to describe Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, that is, the destruction of their society. There is some debate in human rights circles about whether this concept is needed to express Palestinians' reality or whether it tends to delegitimize other concepts that are already used, such as ethnic cleansing and apartheid.
The use of sociocide is essential and so important because we are facing a completely unique situation. The continuous Israeli-Palestinian conflict for more than one century has generated a plethora of literature which covered all aspects of this conflict, including precise recordings of power, policies, and human rights abuses. In this library of anguish, relatively few works provide an accurate theoretical framework for understanding the overall processes of Israeli domination over Palestinians. Palestinian Arabs, like Indians in North America, were not to be by any means part of the new colonial entity. I'm not the first one to state that Israeli policies embody more than the term apartheid. Still, there are people who want to use the concept for different reasons. One of them, because this term is rooted in the international law. Another reason, because they don't have in mind another concept to describe the situation. But some use the term apartheid because in qualifying the system as apartheid, it means that we Palestinians are facing another South African case, meaning that there is a hope to resolve the conflict through one binational state. I don't think that the two-state solutions was feasible since the start, and I also think that the binational one-state solution is not feasible. I mean, let's be serious. If the Israelis don't want to give the Palestinians even part of the remaining 22%, why they should? Because if there will be a binational state, they will give them 50%. Yes or no? So the question rises, what we are facing and how to accurately describe this situation.
That was an excerpt of Palestinian historian Saleh Abdal-Jawad's testimony before the fourth session of the Bertrand Russell International Tribunal on Palestine, which took place in New York City on October 6th and 7th. Find links to more information on the tribunal by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The presidential campaign of 2012 will likely be cited in future history books as having been the election suffering some of the most blatant voter suppression tactics employed by a major political party in decades. After the midterm elections of 2010, when Republican Party majorities took control of many state legislatures and governor's seats, the nation saw a flood of bills restricting access to voting, with the imposition of onerous ID laws, elimination of voter registration programs, and curtailment of early voting schedules. Groups targeted by these laws included racial minorities, senior citizens, and students, demographic groups which not coincidentally often vote for Democratic Party candidates. Although the rationale presented for the passage of these laws was to prevent voter fraud, there is no evidence that fraud has ever been even a minor problem in any state or federal election over the past decade or more. Legal challenges launched by the U.S. Justice Department and public interest groups have succeeded in blocking or delaying many of these laws from being enforced in the November 6th election. Key swing states Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania were among 11 states that had their new voter suppression laws invalidated by state or federal courts. Your reporter spoke with BBC television investigative reporter Greg Palast, who uncovered the Republican purge of tens of thousands of minority voters in the deeply flawed and contested Florida election in 2000. Palast, author of the new book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps, discusses his investigation into voter purges that continue across the country, which could play a decisive role in deciding the winner of the presidential race and key Senate contests across the country.
Interestingly, or disgustingly, we calculated from the raw data, Bobby Kennedy and I, when we were doing our Rolling Stone investigation, I teach statistics, so I went into the raw data of the Elections Assistance Commission and found that 5.9 million votes and voters, well, 2.7 million votes were not counted in the last election, simply cast, not counted. That's an official number. And 3.2 million voters were denied the right to vote, all for cockamamie technical reasons and so-called glitches in the system. Except the color of the glitch is very interesting, Scott. If you're African American, the chance your vote will not get counted, that is, they call it spoiled in the election biz, is 900% higher than if you're a white voter. And that's not because black people are too dumb to vote. It's because they get the worst, just like they get the worst schools and worst hospitals, poor areas get the worst voting equipment and the worst protection against monkey business. So you're talking about 6 million votes missing, and votes and voters missing, overwhelmingly voters of color, overwhelmingly obviously Democrats, and this time expect at least double that number, at least double that number. And even if Obama takes the election, and that's none of my business, all I care about is whether the votes get counted, there's 12 very tight Senate races that are likely to be determined by who gets blocked from voting, not who actually wins the vote. And that's a sick, sick business that's going on right now.
Greg, one of the things that you talk about, and that has to do with a very tight Senate race, you mentioned the criticality of Senate races these days in this election coming up. But what's going on in Arizona with a tight race there?
What's going on is that they're hunting for illegal alien voters. Apparently, they think that 200,000 people, Mexicans, have somehow wandered across the desert or swum the Rio Grande just so they could vote in school board issues or vote for Barack Obama. A state senator, Russell Pierce, they did have a state senator, Russell Pierce, who said that there were 5 million illegal aliens registered as Democrats in the United States. And I said, okay, you and me, Senator, we're going to go bust them. We're going to nail them. I'm going to turn on the cameras for BBC television. This is Greg Palast reporting. We're going to flash the lights on. We're going to handcuff them. We're going to send them to Joe's tent prison. And we couldn't get not 5 million names. I couldn't get 5 names from the guy. He says, well, everyone knows they're there. Finally, he showed me a set of names. He really did. And you know what they were? They were Mexicans in the border area in Nogales who had said that they could not serve on juries because they weren't U.S. citizens. So he said, there they are, admitted aliens. I said, yes, they had driver's licenses as required by the state. If you are a Mexican citizen and you drive in the U.S. on the border, you need to have a U.S. license. And then they call you for jury duty and you have to declare, sorry, I'm not a U.S. citizen. And that's all they did. So basically what he found was legal drivers, not illegal voters. But that, unfortunately, has led to 200,000 people losing their vote. 200,000 people. And their name ain't Smith.
Greg, when you look at this year's election and the preparations that have been made primarily by the Republican Party in trying to skew the vote to help their candidates state by state, all these the new restrictive voter ID laws, and you have the reduction of early voting, and you have many public officials actually on videotape talking about how this will give the Republican candidates a major leg up in the election, they're not being very shy about the whole thing. How does this compare with other years? Because it seems to me it's far more blatant.
It is the worst ever. And that's one of the reasons why I decided to write Billionaires and Ballot Bandits and brought in Ted Rahl and brought in Bobby Kennedy, because I thought of this literally as a national emergency. So, for example, the good old Catherine Harris felon purge is back, and except on steroids. In Florida, they are removing tens of thousands of people from the voter rolls as ex-cons, as people who can't vote because they have a criminal record. And so the ex-cons that they remove, for example, there is one, Mrs. Bobby Moore, who was removed because Mr. Robert Moore committed a crime somewhere. Okay, so Mr. Robert Moore, convicted of a crime, Mrs. Bobby Moore of Florida, loses her vote. See, they have a little algorithm saying, aha, Bobby's Robert, changes sex, changes name, same person, obviously. But one thing they know for sure, Mrs. Bobby Moore is black. How do I know that? Because next to her name, it says BLA. Every person that we are finding, again and again, it's BLA next to their name. It is bigger by a factor of 10 compared to the people that will lose their vote by ID. It's about 10 times as big, the various types of purging and ballot rejection that's going on. So, you know, that's not even covered in the news. And people finally only found out about ID because they have to change laws. This isn't even done with a law change. This is done with complete stealth.
That was BBC television investigative reporter Greg Palast, author of the new New York Times bestselling book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps. Learn more about voter suppression tactics in the 2012 election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.